This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
They are going for it. Brian Koberger's defense team isn't just throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks. They're mounting a full-scale legal assault to try to keep him off of death row. This isn't just about arguing innocence. This is about survival. It is about exhausting every possible legal avenue, every technicality, every gray area in the law to make sure that no matter what happens, Koberger doesn't end up strapped to a gurney in an Idaho execution chamber. And at the center of this fight, 13 separate motions, each one aimed at knocking the death penalty off the table before a jury even gets a chance to consider it. Idaho is not shy about the death penalty. It's one of the 27 states that still actually use it. And it has a history of handing down capital punishment for particularly heinous crimes. The state's legal framework makes it clear first-degree murder can be a death penalty case if the prosecution proves certain aggravating factors, things like multiple victims, a murder committed in a particularly cruel way, or a killing that shows a complete disregard for human life. If a jury convicts Koberger, and if they find those aggravating factors, which they probably should, he could very well be sentenced to death. That's why his defense team is fighting like hell to make sure it never gets to that point. Their strategy? Well, initially, argue that Idaho's entire approach to the death penalty is flawed, unconstitutional, and fundamentally unfair. One of their biggest claims is that the death penalty is falling out of favor across the country. The point to the fact that several states have abandoned capital punishment in recent years, while others have put moratoriums on executions. The argument here is that if fewer states are using the death penalty, it reflects an evolving standard of decency in American society. It's always interesting to hear the defense counsel for someone who is being charged with killing four people in one setting, arguing evolving standard of decency. And it's not even at the merits anymore of the case. It's just about, well, if he is guilty, here's why you shouldn't kill him, because there's evolving standards of decency. I know a lot of you are saying one thing right now in your head, and it's something that your parents probably said to you if you were 90s kids. Well, you better should have thought of that before you did that, or something of that nature. I think that's how it would have been said in Wisconsin. Better should have thought of that before you did that. Something like that. Oh, yeah. Better should have thought of that before you did that there, son. You know, yeah. That's where I grew up. That's what I heard around me. Evolving standard of decency. Something the Supreme Court has recognized in past cases when evaluating whether a punishment is cruel and unusual. The defense is essentially saying, hey, look, the rest of the country is moving away from this, so why should Idaho still be doing it? You know, Timmy doesn't have to do that chore anymore. Why do we? It's an interesting argument, but here's the problem. Idaho doesn't care. The honey badger doesn't care. What California or New York is doing. Idaho is still very much in the execution business, has been, will be for some time to come, likely. And unless the Supreme Court swoops in and changes the game, it's likely not going to happen, the state isn't about just to roll over because other places have decided to go in a different direction. But that's just the first part of the defense's argument. They're also going after Idaho's methods of execution. If the state goes through with an execution, it has two options, lethal injection or the firing squad. The last one probably made you do a double take unless you already knew about this. But yes, Idaho has brought back the firing squad as a backup method in case lethal injection drugs become unavailable. So it's not like, oh, we lethally inject you and you're sitting there shaking and having seizures. Bring in the squad! Say goodbye, Charlie. No, that's not how that works. If the drugs are unavailable, because apparently we have a real hard time killing ourselves on purpose in this country. I mean, we do it so many other ways, but when it's actually the one goal of the product, we have a real hard time producing the drug that does that. Does it make any sense? No, it doesn't at all. It doesn't. So they say if we can't get the drug, well, then we're going to have to bring in the firing squad. And they argue that both of these options amount to cruel and unusual punishment. Lethal injection has been under heavy scrutiny in recent years because of many botched executions where inmates took painfully long to die. How you screw that up, I don't know. It seems fairly straight. I feel like I could find household chemicals around my house right now and make a cocktail that would probably take me out pretty quick. If I if the aliens are coming and it's like, okay, let's go, that sort of a deal. I don't know why. Again, I don't understand why it is such a difficult thing. I know there's only so many companies that the government will use and all that, but I mean, come on. People are finding ways to do this in their homes every day. We can't tackle this one. The firing squad, that's a whole other can of worms. The defense claims that being shot to death is not only barbaric, but also a throwback to a time when executions were public spectacles. I would argue that you might get high viewership on this one if you decided to do an HBO special on it. Then there's the issue of time. Koberger's attorneys argue that the death penalty trial requires extensive preparation, more than they've been given. They claim that 10 months at the time when they filed all this was not nearly enough to build a proper defense in a capital case. Well, maybe you have about 3 years by the time you get to court now. They said that without more time, Koberger's right to effective counsel is being violated. It's a fair argument. Death penalty cases are notoriously complex, and the defense team has to gather mitigation evidence, interview experts, and prepare for a two-phase trial, one phase to determine guilt and another to determine whether Koberger should be executed. It's essentially like two trials back-to-back. It's a double feature. They're essentially arguing that the state is rushing them into trial and putting their client's life on the line without giving them time or a chance to properly defend him. Okay. Here's the thing with all of that, although they did get more time. The judge didn't buy most of the arguments. Because eventually, in this case, on November 20th, 2024, Judge Stephen Hippler shut down every single one of the defense's attempts to take the death penalty off the table. He ruled that Idaho's execution methods, while controversial, are still legal. He ruled that the state's death penalty laws are constitutional. He ruled that the timeline of the trial is reasonable given the circumstances. And most importantly, he ruled that the death penalty remains in play. This means that if Koberger is convicted, he'll still have to face the possibility of being sentenced to death. And at this point, the only real way for the defense to stop that from happening is to convince the jury either by proving his innocence or by introducing mitigating factors that would make execution seem too extreme. And that's where things get even more interesting. That brings us to today. In early 2025, Koberger's defense team quietly handed over a batch of mental health records to the prosecution. You might remember us reporting on this a handful of weeks ago. The contents of these records remain sealed. But their existence tells us something important. The defense is preparing to argue that Koberger's mental state should be considered as a mitigating factor if he is convicted. Just note, the prosecution is already in the motions of saying, No, we don't think that that's okay. It'll be up to the judge eventually. It is a significant move on the part of Koberger. In death penalty cases, the defense often introduces evidence of mental illness, neurodevelopmental disorders, or past trauma to argue that the defendant's culpability is reduced. Not gone, just reduced. In some cases, this kind of evidence has been enough to persuade a jury to spare the defendant's life, even in the face of overwhelming evidence of guilt. And while Idaho doesn't allow an insanity defense at trial, mental health issues can still play a huge role in sentencing. The question is, what's in those records? What is the defense planning to argue? The answer might be even more controversial than anything they have done so far, because if the rumors are true, they might be preparing to argue that Brian Koberger is on the autism spectrum and that his neurodevelopmental condition should be taken into account when determining whether he deserves to die. An argument that would be a legal grenade. Autism spectrum disorder isn't typically used as a defense in criminal cases, and it's clearly not recognized as a reason to avoid the death penalty. But if the defense can convince the jury that Koberger's condition impaired his ability to process emotions, understand social cues, or control his actions in the way a neurotypical person would, they might be able to shift the narrative in a way that makes execution seem unnecessarily harsh. Of course, that's a massive gamble. Jurors might see it as a last-ditch effort to avoid accountability. The prosecution will almost certainly push back, arguing that whatever neurological condition Koberger may have had, it didn't stop him from allegedly planning and executing a brutal crime. And the biggest hurdle? Idaho law doesn't explicitly exempt people with autism from the death penalty the way it does for people with intellectual disabilities. That means this argument isn't just a legal long shot, it's completely uncharted territory. The next phase of this case, it's shaping up to be a battle over more than just facts and evidence. It's becoming a fight over what justice looks like and who deserves mercy and whether a diagnosis can or should change the outcome of a death penalty case. And that's a fight that could change everything. Autism spectrum disorder, three words that up until now haven't been at the center of a death penalty case quite like this. Well, if you look at a lot of cases, probably present in a lot. Not an excuse. In no way, shape, or form. And I don't really think it should preclude you from getting the death penalty either. But part of the recipe sometimes. And look, most people on that spectrum are not killers. I consider myself one of them. Not a killer, but over there. But understanding that, you see some of these people's outlooks, these characteristics, these tendencies that go off in bizarre, obsessive ways, the way that that mind works, and where they are on that spectrum. There's a certain place somewhere there where it enables one to go down those roads without seeming to have an understanding of repercussions. That's why you see so many cases like this. So if this is argued, if this is successfully argued, this would be a big deal. Because I would argue you could argue this in probably 70-ish percent of cases, maybe higher. If Koberger's defense team is heading in the direction that many suspect, they're about to introduce an argument that has never truly been tested in this way. That his alleged neurodevelopmental condition should spare him from execution. Autism is not a mental illness. It's a neurological difference that affects social interaction, communication, and behavior. Some people with autism struggle with impulsive control. Some have difficulty reading social cues or understanding emotional ways people communicate that neurotypical individuals do, and some exhibit excessive behaviors, intense focus, specific interests, or rigid thinking patterns. Or they're insanely successful and do really amazing things in this world, things that neurotypical people couldn't do or wouldn't have the drive to do. I hate it when it always goes so negative. It's like, look at half of our leaders out there, you know, the good ones. I guess it depends who we're talking or who's answering the question. It's there. It can be used as a superpower too. Just saying. It's a spectrum, meaning that the effects vary widely from person to person. But one thing is clear, autism on its own has never been an automatic shield from criminal responsibility. Legally speaking, the justice system has drawn a line in the sand when it comes to capital punishment and certain mental conditions. The U.S. Supreme Court set a landmark precedent in Atkins versus Virginia in 2002 when it ruled that executing individuals with intellectual disabilities violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. The reasoning was that people with significantly impaired cognitive function, those with an IQ below a certain threshold, cannot be held to the same standard of responsibility as neurotypical individuals. But autism, it's never been explicitly included in that ruling. It exists in a legal gray area. And by the way, if you're basing that one on IQ, you're going to find insanely high IQs over there. On high functioning, anyway. And that's where Koberger's defense might see an opportunity. And I'll be corrected. Even in lower functioning doesn't mean that they don't have that all going on by any means. I'm a big proponent of this, if you don't already understand that, of awareness and understanding. They've already filed a motion that specifically references autism spectrum disorder, signaling that they might attempt to argue that his neurological makeup should be factored into his sentencing if he's convicted. The problem is they haven't provided any formal diagnosis, and that might be a problem, at least not yet. So what happens if they do? If Koberger is officially diagnosed with ASD, his attorneys could argue that his condition impacted his ability to fully comprehend the social and emotional weight of his alleged actions. They might claim that he struggled with interpersonal relationships, had difficulty interpreting emotions, or even had an impaired ability to regulate impulses. They might argue that his obsessive tendencies, if present, played a role in how he allegedly planned or carried out the crime. In short, they're likely to say that he's not the same kind of criminal as others who have faced a death penalty, and that executing him would be a miscarriage of justice. Yeah. Here's the problem with that argument. Autism is not an intellectual disability. Unlike cases that have fallen under Atkins versus Virginia, individuals with autism can have very normal or even above average intelligence. They can understand right from wrong. They can plan, they can manipulate. And if the prosecution pushes back, they'll almost certainly argue that whatever diagnosis Koberger may or may not have had, it didn't stop him from allegedly engaging in meticulous planning before the crime, nor did it prevent him from allegedly taking calculated steps to avoid being caught. Because if that's the case, he can probably do it better than others. And then fail miserably on just one little thing, one obvious thing. So for the jury to buy this argument, they would have to believe that his neurological condition significantly impaired his ability to make moral decisions. And that is a hard sell. There are cases that offer insight into how this might play out. In Idaho, there was a State versus Aiden Herrero in 2017, in which a defendant with an autism diagnosis was spared the death penalty. His legal team successfully argued that his neurodevelopmental disorder played a role in his actions, and prosecutors ultimately withdrew their death penalty notice. That case, however, was resolved through a plea deal before it ever reached a jury. Koberger's situation is different. If he goes to trial and is convicted, his fate will be in the hands of 12 jurors who may or may not find the autism argument very compelling. A case that stands in contrast is Robertson versus Texas, a death penalty case that gained national attention because Robinson, who is autistic, was sentenced to death despite his defense team arguing that his disorder made him emotionally detached rather than remorseless. Prosecutors used his flat affect against him, claiming it was evidence of his guilt and lack of remorse. That case highlights the risk of Koberger's defense taking this road. If jurors are unfamiliar with autism or if they equate his symptoms with coldness or lack of empathy, the argument could backfire entirely. And there's U.S. versus Zuck in 2018, a federal case where an autistic defendant initially received a dramatically reduced sentence because of his diagnosis. But when the case was appealed, the court ruled that ASD alone was not a sufficient reason for extreme leniency. That ruling sets a precedent that federal courts and potentially Idaho's may lean on if they feel Koberger's legal team is overreaching. The prosecution, no doubt, will have their own experts ready to counter any autism-based argument. They will argue that Koberger, if guilty, knew exactly what he was doing, that his alleged behavior, stalking the victims, turning off his phone at crucial moments, attempting to cover his tracks, demonstrates forethought, calculation, and clear intent. And they'll say that no matter what his neurological profile is, it doesn't change the fact that he meticulously planned every detail. And that's the heart of the fight. If Koberger is convicted, does his diagnosis, if he has one, make his crime any less deserving of the ultimate punishment? Or will a jury see it as a last-ditch effort to escape accountability? I don't know. This trial isn't just about whether or not autism should be considered in a death penalty case, but it's about whether the justice system is ready to weigh the complexities of neurodevelopmental disorders and determining moral culpability. That's a battle that's only just beginning, amazingly, considering it's usually at the center of almost every case. It's true. We're just getting there now. Maybe we should understand mental health more in crime cases. It's kind of shocking, but it is what it is. Brian Koberger's story didn't start in a courtroom. Long before his name became synonymous with one of the most high-profile murder cases in recent memory, he was just a kid who didn't quite seem to fit in. And if his defense team is preparing to argue that he falls somewhere on the autism spectrum, it's these early years that they'll point to as evidence. People who knew Koberger in high school describe him as socially awkward, isolated, and often on the receiving end of relentless bullying. Some say he had a hard time reading social cues, struggled to maintain relationships, and was an easy target because of his unusual mannerisms. There are stories of him being teased, ostracized, and humiliated, experiences that, if he does have undiagnosed autism, would align with the kind of social struggles many on the spectrum face, especially during adolescence. And let's be honest. Look at the guy. Look at his cues. Look at what we know. Look at what we've seen about him. Yeah, he's there. I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose him. But I tell you what, I would bet the house that he is on the spectrum. But was this autism? Or was this simply the experience of an awkward teenager who never quite found his place? That's a million-dollar question, although both of those sometimes do go hand in hand. Because while social difficulties are the hallmark of ASD, they're not exclusive to it. Plenty of kids struggle with fitting in, plenty of people experience bullying, and not all of them commit violent crimes. Not all of them are on the spectrum. So if his defense team wants to use his past to argue for leniency, they'll have to convince a jury that his struggles weren't just ordinary social missteps, but signs of something deeper, something neurological. And there's a question of this. Of his rigid and obsessive behaviors. Koberger's strict dietary habits have raised eyebrows, with reports that he adhered to an extreme form of veganism, so extreme that he reportedly wouldn't eat food cooked in pans that had ever touched animal products. Yeah, that's not autism at all. To most, that might sound like a personal preference taken to an unusual level, but those familiar with ASD, it's kind of a sensory-driven rigidity that can sometimes be a trait of the condition. The same goes for his reportedly odd interactions with people. A woman who went on a Tinder date with him claimed he made a strange comment about her birthing hips. Like you do on a first date. And that his behavior was off-putting enough for her to cut the date short. Was this just a case of someone being socially awkward, or was it an example of someone with ASD struggling to understand appropriate social interaction? These kinds of incidents might seem minor on their own, but in the courtroom, they could become bigger pieces of a larger puzzle, one that the defense will likely argue paints Koberger as a man who has struggled with social norms, sensory sensitivities, and rigid thinking his entire life. The goal? To make the case that his alleged actions were influenced, at least in part, by a neurological condition rather than pure malice. But the biggest factor that could play into this argument is his demeanor, specifically his flat affect and apparent emotional detachment. People who have observed him in court have noted that he rarely shows emotion. He's been described as blank, unreadable, and at times eerily calm. To someone familiar with autism, this might look like the behavior of a cold, remorseless individual. But to someone who understands ASD, compared to someone who doesn't, it could just be how his brain processes and expresses emotion. Really, may not mean anything at all. Or it might mean a lot as well. Kind of like, this is your explanation. Doesn't make it right. Should be punished. But how do you get someone who's capable of doing something like that? Well, they have to have a lack of emotions. They have to have a lack of empathy. And be hurting so badly to feel anything that they're driven to try and take on such a horrible, horrible motion, event, crime, just to try and feel something. Because that's what people like this are doing. They're so void of feeling that they have to go and do crazy, extreme things just to say, I felt something. And that little spark of something is what they get. And then they continue on. This is where things could get complicated, because whether he has ASD or not, perception is everything. If a jury sees him as emotionless, they may be more likely to view him as dangerous and deserving of the harshest punishment. If they believe his lack of visible emotion is a result of autism, they may be more inclined to see him as someone whose brain works differently, not necessarily someone who should be executed, but someone who, rather, not someone who should be excused, but someone who shouldn't be executed. At the same time, Koberger's defense has an uphill battle when it comes to his alibi. As the trial approaches, a new legal fight has emerged over how much weight his claimed whereabouts on the night of the murder should be given. Koberger's attorneys have stated that he was out driving alone, stargazing. Remember that? He likes to look at the stars. That's what he was doing. That's your alibi? Seriously? That's his alibi. Stargazing. But here's the problem. There's no evidence to support it. And the prosecutors want to make sure the jury doesn't hear anything about it unless it comes directly from him. Which would be rather interesting, no, wouldn't it? In a new filing, the prosecution is asking the judge to limit any evidence the defense can present regarding his alibi, arguing that since Koberger has had 20 months to provide supporting material but hasn't, the defense should be restricted from introducing anything beyond Koberger's own words. In other words, unless Koberger himself testifies that he was out driving that night, it's like daring him to come to the stand. Come here, Brian. We'd like to hear from you. His lawyers won't be able to suggest it in court. That could put the defense in a bind, tough spot, you know, because if Koberger does take the stand, he opens himself up to cross-examination, which could be disastrous if the prosecution picks apart his story, which of course they will. And if he is on the spectrum and he's not that personable or social, like we've seen that he is not, and very rigid, like we've seen that he likely is, of course, all allegedly, they don't do well under questioning pressure. That's kind of where things fold in. At least I think in his personality it would. Again, I'm not a doctor, but I read a lot of people every day. I don't think he would do well in Cross. The legal maneuvering doesn't stop there. Prosecutors are also seeking to bar the defense from introducing any psychiatric evaluations as evidence. Yes, so they're trying to say, even if he does have ASD, it doesn't matter. We're not letting this in. This move comes after the defense officially filed a motion titled Motion to Strike Death Penalty RE Autism Spectrum Disorder. See? It's making the rounds. This is what's going on behind closed doors right now. Making it clear that they plan to introduce ASD as part of their mitigation argument, but without a formal diagnosis or concrete evidence, the prosecution wants to prevent the jury from even considering it. This all underscores the tensions at play. The defense is trying to weave a narrative that Koberger's behaviors, his rigid routines, his social struggles, his lack of visible emotion points to an undiagnosed condition that should be taken into account, especially when determining his fate. The prosecution, meanwhile, is working just as hard to strip away any argument that could complicate their case. They don't want jurors to hear about an unverified diagnosis. They don't want them to hear about an unsupported alibi. They want to keep the focus strictly on the crime and the evidence that allegedly links Koberger to it. Everything else is noise. That's what Ann Taylor wants it to be. It's her job. And this is where jurors will have to decide how much weight to give these arguments. Will they see Koberger's reported social struggles, his odd behavior, and his blank courtroom demeanor as signs of a man with a neurological condition that should be considered when deciding his fate? Or will they see those same traits as something else? Irrelevant. Quirks of a personality rather than legitimate mitigating factors. Cases like Robert Robertson's have shown that autism can be misinterpreted in the courtroom, sometimes leading to harsher sentencing rather than leniency. But that doesn't mean jurors in the case will see it the same way. If the defense introduces ASD as the mitigating factor, they will be asking a jury to consider not just what Koberger allegedly did, but why he did it, and whether his brain worked differently enough to warrant sparing his life. And in a case of this high-profile magnitude, with this much public scrutiny, that might be the hardest sell of all. In a case that is full of hard sells. What's next for Koberger? We'll have to see. Will the judge boot the argument of anything health-related? That's going to be the next determining factor. If he lets it in, that really could be very interesting because it could be a double-edged sword for the defense of Brian Koberger. Introduce it, you may save his life. But introduce it and you might also convict him. Because it does play very much into the story arc, the character arc of what we understand him to be on a very deep level. It puts the arc there. When otherwise the arc's just kind of like floating out here, we're trying to find a base for it. If we're going to argue this, like, yes, that does very much line up with his behavior. Will this even get to trial? Because if you're already arguing this point, you have to consider that they are very much advising Koberger that at this point, we don't know what we're going to be able to do for you. Maybe the best thing we can do is get the death penalty off the table and maybe you plea. Is that the right choice for this trial? Or for this case or for these families? That's very much up to them. I cannot answer that. But at the end of the day, it's about justice. And if that's how justice comes about, I guess then so be it.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. She was a doting mother, the kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. the perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.